Tracy Dressner for Petitioner Demetrius Franklin. Before I begin the argument, I wanted to make two... first of all, I want to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. And then I wanted to make two points. One is that there's an overarching fact in this case, and that is that Mr. Franklin was convicted solely on the basis solely of one witness. There was no other evidence. This is not one of those exaggerated, we're making something up. There was only Ms. Day's testimony and nothing else that connected him to this case. The other is that Mr. Franklin's primary objective in his habeas petition and in this appeal is to have his Brady claim heard by the federal court. So I'm going to start with when the statute of limitations period began. In this case, it began on the date on which the actual predicate could have been discovered through due diligence. And that date, as I'm going to explain, was on April 1st, 2016, when his attorney, the California Innocence Project, was able to get unsealed a letter from an L.A. Sheriff's captain, homicide captain, in which he requested sentencing favors for Ms. Day in exchange for her testimony that she had given in Mr. Franklin's trial.
But Ms. Dresser, what about April 13th, 2000, which was the expiration of the federal habeas claim?
Well, this date runs from the latest of which date applies, and in this case, the date was when he discovered the factual predicate for his Brady claim. And the reason, now I know the Attorney General's position and the District Court's position was that the factual predicate date began on the date that Ms. Day actually got the sentencing benefit. And the reason that is not the appropriate date to use is really based on the reasoning of the two cases I cited in my brief, the Jefferson versus United States and Moore versus Knight. And those cases stand for the proposition that when judges and prosecutors make statements that foreclose a possible legal claim, a defendant can't be penalized for relying on those statements. So what we have in this case is, I'm sorry, what's our question?
Well, I was just going to follow up and inquire. Surely the test is the Brady claim could have been discovered, but isn't it true that Mr. Franklin had actual notice of the leniency offered to Shanti Day during the trial?
He did not. What happened was Mr. Franklin's attorney raised the issue that she had a pending case. And the attorney specifically wanted to ask her when she testified whether she was getting any favors. The prosecutor stood up in court and said, I didn't even know that she had a current case, and of course I know my obligation, and of course if she was getting any favors or any deal or anything, I know my obligation and I would do that. So then the judge forbid Mr. Franklin's attorney from asking Ms. Day whether she was receiving any favors. Could not ask about it. Then what happens is a week or two after she testifies, now first of all, she had been able to plead while she had prior to a felony petty theft with priors. She was able to plead to a misdemeanor petty theft. But then between the time that she testified and Mr. Franklin's sentencing, unbeknownst to Mr. Franklin, the sheriff's homicide captain wrote a letter to her sentencing judge asking for two favors, that her fine be stayed and that her probation should be reinstated to probation rather than serving any jail time. Prior to Mr. Franklin's sentencing, on the day of his sentencing, there was a new trial motion that re-argued the issue about the attorney being foreclosed and asking her about a deal. And the prosecutor stood up again and said
counsel, is this on May 21st, 1997?
Yes.
During the motion for new trial?
Yes.
And didn't
yes.
the prosecutor acknowledge that Ashanti Day received leniency? And of course, he disavowed it was an exchange for anything, but didn't he acknowledge it at that time?
No. What he said was, I represent to the court, I have represented to the court at that time that I wasn't aware and there were no arrangements made with her to any regard of disposition of that case. I don't know what has become of that case. Okay, so now you have two problems. You have one, you have the prosecutor who knew that there was a pending case, knew that Mr. Franklin's attorney had raised the issue. He'd been denied an opportunity to request, to ask her about whether she got a deal. And then he puts his head in the sand. And then he thinks he can just claim a lack of knowledge. Well, he has a constitutional obligation to provide the defense with the information that she received a sentencing benefit prior to the time he stood up in court and said he wasn't aware of anything, and he didn't turn it over. So if you would accept at face value prosecutor statements made in court, then Mr. Franklin at that point had to say, okay, I guess I was wrong. I guess there was no benefit given. I can rest on the fact that she didn't receive a benefit. The onus wasn't on him to go find somebody to go look at Ms. Day's criminal file and then discover that there was a minute order saying she had gotten a benefit or that she had gotten a sentencing break.
Yeah, counsel, may I jump ahead just a bit? I mean,
sure.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that you're correct and April 1, 2016 was the correct date. Then the statute ran on April 2, 2017, and the petition wasn't filed for another 60 days.
Correct.
And I understand your argument that he was relying on the California Innocence Project, but if they were not counsel of record, how does that get you there?
Well, it depends how you define counsel of record. They represented themselves as his attorney. They filed documents. That's how they got the letter unsealed. It's in my excerpt of record.
No. I understand that. You've got the two appearances there, and I guess there's an implication that they're going to file a habeas petition. But isn't that the best you have? They didn't ever agree to do it.
They never did. Nothing that we have in the record shows that they ever definitively agreement. We have two letters that were written by the law students who work on these cases in the Innocence Project implying that they were going to raise it. But then, okay, so if they're not going to do it, they have an obligation to tell Mr. Franklin that he has a claim that has a due date. They don't do that. When they drop him, they don't say, and by the way, that Brady claim that we talked to you about in those letters has a due date. That's, you know, that's like basic lawyering 101.
But I guess my question is, it's a little bit difficult case. They filed some motions on his behalf to get documents, but they did not accept representation of him vis-a-vis the habeas petition. And in fact, they said, no, sorry, we're not going to do that. So I guess, where does this fit? Because they...
I guess we don't know what they actually promised him or didn't promise him. How does Mr. Franklin, sitting in his prison cell, know when he receives a document that says attorney for Demetrius Franklin that those attorneys aren't really representing him? I mean, there's this, it seems like kind of a sham if they can insulate themselves that way. And I feel badly kind of attacking the Innocence Project here because they do some fine work, but they leave petitioners like Mr. Franklin, who are otherwise proceeding pro per, in this weird kind of limbo where they assume that they're represented and they don't find out that they have a deadline. Now, Mr. Franklin clearly wanted to get his case before the court within 75 days of being abandoned. He had found counsel, and they got their petitions filed. I mean, you couldn't work more diligently than that. And equitable tolling is about fairness. And all he's asking for is to have his Brady claim, which he had reason to believe the Innocence Project was going to pursue, heard by the federal court. Had they told him 6 months earlier, 2 months earlier, 75 days earlier, he would have had his petition in on time. But he had no idea that they, one, weren't going to represent him, and two, that he had a deadline coming up. And equitable tolling is about reasonable diligence. He was reasonably diligent. He had reason to believe that the Innocence Project was representing him and was going to do the habeas. When he found out that was wrong, he immediately did all that you could reasonably expect an incarcerated inmate, an indigent incarcerated inmate, to do to get his petitions before the court. Equitable tolling is an equitable remedy to ensure fairness. And the way to ensure fairness in this case is to let Mr. Franklin have his day in court on the Brady claim. And that is so critically important because the Brady claim casts a credibility issue with this only witness that ties into this case. And if this was a case, as we often hear, of overwhelming evidence, we might be in a different situation. But Mr. Franklin has been in prison for the last 23 years based on the testimony of a witness who received sentencing favors in her own criminal case for testifying against him, a witness who otherwise was presented to the jury as a neutral, non-interested party, when in fact she wasn't. And it wasn't just that they received that they didn't get that information. It was that Mr. Franklin's attorney had specifically sought to ask that information and was barred from doing so because the prosecutor stood there and said there was no such deal.
Ms. Dressler, can I ask you a quick question? I thought I saw somewhere in the record, I may be wrong here, that she recanted her testimony.
Yes. So one of the things that the Innocence Project did was send some law students out to interview her. And during that interview, she said she didn't really remember Mr. Franklin being there. She didn't remember a lot of details. And that is all the information that we have at this point. So if for some reason the court rejects the statute of limitations argument and the equitable tolling argument, the other pathway for Mr. Franklin to get back into federal court is on a showing of actual innocence. And I readily admit that the declaration and information that we have about Ms. Day is not itself sufficient, but he ought to have the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing, get Ms. Day in there, and let's get her testimony before a judge, and let's see whether there really is a true recantation, because this really goes to the innocence of Mr. Franklin.
You're down to 2 minutes. You want to reserve?
Yeah, I do. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Mr. Thede, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Paul Thede for the people. Your Honors, appellant was not entitled to a later start date for the statute of limitations in this case, specifically for the Brady claim. In order to get an alternative trigger date, there needs to be a factual predicate for the claim. And in looking at the letter itself says that there supports the notion that there was no deal in this case. There's certainly no quid pro quo. To quote the letter itself, quote, Ms. Day was never promised anything other than protection and assistance in relocating. And noting that since her testimony, the detectives had learned that she had been convicted of petty theft. That letter, I'm not sure how that gets Ms. Dresner to the point of showing that there's this hidden deal that she speculates exists. And the letter simply asks for a fine reduction. So even if that letter did act as a factual predicate for the Brady claim that Ms. Dresner now led, it could have been discovered through due diligence. The letter itself existed at the time of appellant sentencing. The record doesn't show when the letter itself was actually sealed. There's nothing to show that a cop could have done exactly what the California Innocence Project had done 9 years later.
Mr. Thede,
counsel, where is that letter? What letter are you referring to?
The Morrow letter, Your Honor, on page 101 to 102 of the excerpts of record.
Okay. What about my question to your opposing counsel about what happened on May 21st? To what extent did Mr. Franklin have knowledge of the leniency that was granted to Ms. Day?
Your Honor, by May 21st, at that point, we had already had a preliminary hearing in which all parties agreed that there was a pending case that had been reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor. At that point, the prosecutor reiterated that he was unfamiliar with the outcome of that case and that he could only reiterate that there was no deal in exchange for a testimony in the particular trial that he was handling, and that he couldn't speak to the disposition of this unrelated misdemeanor theft, which goes to the point that the prosecutor's statements here do not affect due diligence, because it doesn't show that their letter does not exist. It shows that it simply reiterates what was already known, which is that there was a pending misdemeanor case that they did not know the outcome of.
But the fact of the reduction to a misdemeanor was known at that time and disclosed, is that correct or not?
That was understood amongst all the parties before the trial began, Your Honor, yes.
So when the prosecutor repeatedly asserted that there was no deal with the witness, your position is that prosecutor was speaking truthfully, and that if there was a reduction in her sentence, it had absolutely nothing to do with this case at all. It was for something else.
That is what the prosecutor testified to, Your Honor, or explained that on the record, Your Honor, correct.
All right. No, that's the Attorney General's position.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what the record shows, and we're consistent with the record, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, even if that district attorney's position had some sort of effect on what was required in due diligence here, it did not have the effect. It cannot have had the effect that appellant now claims it did, because appellant's proposed trigger date is contrary to what this court has held the standard to be. Appellant doesn't ask that this court find that the trigger date was sometime after 2012 when the California Innocence Project knew this letter existed, or even in 2015 on November 20th, when the record shows that the California Innocence Project knew what the letter actually contained. The appellant instead asks this court find that the proposed trigger date is April 1st, 2016, the day the letter was actually sealed, the day that the California Innocence Project had it in their hands. And as this court has held in Board v. Gonzalez, the trigger date in these cases is not when it was actually discovered, but when it could have been discovered through due diligence. So it simply cannot have had the effect that appellant proposes it has. However, as this court has noted, even if the statute of limitations did begin on April 1st, as appellant acknowledges, it's still untimely and it would still need to prove equitable tolling, which appellant does not. And that brings me to my next point, which is that appellant was not entitled to equitable tolling. Your Honor, in looking at reasonable diligence, assuming the statute of limitations does not begin on April 1st as appellant proposes, you have 13 years at least unexplained of inactivity. That cannot be reasonable diligence in pursuing his claims. However, even assuming that alternative trigger date did begin on April 1st, there's still not an extraordinary circumstance that prevented appellant from filing his petition on time. Because here, as this court has noted, there is no agreement by the California Innocence Project to file a federal habeas petition on his behalf.
Do we know? I mean, we don't have anything in the record on that. We just have the appearance of the California Innocence Project.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there is outlined.
Normally, there would be a letter saying we're only going to investigate, or we're taking your case on, or something. And it's just absent from the record here.
Directly, Your Honor, yes. However, there is evidence suggested by the supervisor's declaration, Raquel Cohen, on page 104 of the excerpts of record, that outlines that the California Innocence Project, in this case, as it was in general, to investigate claims of actual innocence. Investigation is not the same as filing a habeas petition on their behalf.
Well, that's true, but how do you account for the fact that they actually filed two motions?
That's consistent with the investigation of actual innocence.
But they were acting as attorneys, correct?
In investigating actual innocence claim, yes, Your Honor. However, what we're dealing with here is whether there's an understanding that there will be a federal habeas petition filed on his behalf, and there's simply nothing to suggest that there is, that he would. And furthermore, there's nothing to show that it prevented him from filing specifically this Brady claim on his own in time. He had the letter, as shown on page 113 of the excerpts of record.
So what do you make of Pew v. Bider? What would you say? Pew v. Bider, that's our en banc case where we said the standard is not impossible.
Oh,
And the district, I mean, you seem to suggest he had to be prevented, which I think is inconsistent with you. But also, the district court used that standard, the impossibility standard, incorrectly. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
So wouldn't the normal course be to remand to apply the correct standard?
Not when in the case, not if the result would be the same, Your Honor, given the fact that, although admittedly, Appelli acknowledges that the district court here did apply the impossible standard as to finding of extraordinary circumstances, that's only one part of equitable tolling. And here there still needs to be a finding of reasonable diligence. And the court, the record shows that the district court here used that appropriate standard, which, given the fact that that's an essential element of finding equitable tolling in general, it would to remand the case down for the district court to find the exact same holding for the same reason basically applying the different standard oaths for one part of equitable tolling doesn't change the overall outcome, Your Honor.
Well, it happens.
That's fair, Your Honor. That is fair. But again, even in looking into, before I see my time starting to go a little low, I behoove myself if I didn't address the actual innocence gateway standard here. Unless,
please go ahead with the Schlupp analysis.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, here, this court has found the Schlupp standard or Schlupp standard is a very high standard. The vast majority of cases fail. And the types of evidence found to meet the Schlupp standard, that of exculpatory scientific evidence, trustworthy eyewitness evidence, or critical physical evidence, we don't have anything close to what courts have found to be meet the Schlupp standard, Your Honor. And here, and I want to make a quick point on this, what the district court had in front of it was a 2017 declaration summarizing a 2014 conversation with a person who we don't have any foundation was actually Shanti Day. Now, on appeal, appellant includes a 2013 California Innocence Project memo that appears to support some of the findings from that 2017 declaration. However, as appellant acknowledges on page 27 of their reply brief, that was not made available to the district court. So in reviewing whether the district court properly found that there was an actual innocence gateway here, it should not consider something that was not before the district court. So in looking into what the district court had in front of it, this 2017 declaration, it is incredibly unreliable and untrustworthy. As previously established, it's describing from memory a hearsay statement made 3 years earlier about a conversation about events that had happened 17 years before that. That's not. Furthermore, there's no foundation in that letter to establish that it was actually Shanti Day they were talking to. And the record here has rather evidence to the contrary, given the fact that we have a letter from the California Innocence Project telling appellant that it had not yet found Shanti Day, supposedly a year after this conversation had taken place. Furthermore, that statement is clearly made by a person suffering from serious mental illnesses, and that person, supposedly Shanti Day, doesn't remember even accusing appellant of the trial. So therefore, this does not meet anything close to the reliability that the Schlupp standard requires. Nor would providing an evidentiary hearing help appellant at all, as it only removes one degree of reliability, only includes one degree of reliability amongst many, and certainly would not have shown that it is more likely than not that no reasonable juror could find appellant guilty in that particular case. Because this is not even close to meeting the Schlupp standard, appellant just should not have another chance to develop facts they failed to develop for 23 years. And this court should not allow appellant a second bite at a very old apple. Unless the court has any other questions, we're prepared to submit.
Any further questions? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Rebuttal.
A lot to unpack there. I'm going to start backwards from where he started. Again, much like the equitable tolling, the actual innocence gateway exists to prevent a miscarriage of justice. And to just let this case end when there was only one witness against Mr. Franklin, without having his case, his issues regarding Ms. Day heard, would be a miscarriage of justice. Mr. Franklin has acknowledged he hasn't proven the Schlupp standard, but all he's seeking is an opportunity to put on his evidence. Let's get Ms. Day in there. It'll take one hearing. Either she's trustworthy or she's not. But to just say, well, and this whole issue, I might add, only arose after Mr. Franklin filed his petition. He asked for a stay while he exhausted his claims in state court, and then he was blindsided by the untimely dismissal. And then there was a whole issue with his objections. So he wasn't there to prove at that moment his actual innocence. He didn't know he had to do this gateway, this possible gateway issue. Going back to what he could have discovered, on page 103 of the excerpts of record is the minute order regarding Ms. Day's sentencing. And let me preface that. There were two possible acts of leniency. The one that the court referred to earlier about the reduction to the misdemeanor isn't the issue now. The issue now is the sentencing breaks that she got, which the homicide captain specifically tied to her testimony in this case. If you look at the minute order, which is all that anyone would have seen had they gone to look at the case file, all it says is that the court received a letter from the captain, from the homicide captain, that the DA had no objection, and the court struck the fine and reinstated her to probation. It doesn't even tie it to this case. It's not clear from the record how the Innocence Project found out that the letter existed or that it was sealed. She only found out the information that was actually contained in the letter when a court clerk told her what some of the under seal information was. Now, to think that a court clerk would somehow reveal that information under seal to an incarcerated inmate is really pretty preposterous. The only way they found out what the letter actually said was by getting it unsealed. And then when you read that letter, yes, the captain claims that there was no deal, but we know from the hundreds of cases, hundreds, perhaps thousands of cases out there, that police officers lie about what deals they've had all the time. We can't end this inquiry just because the police officer said that. And in fact, we know that there's already an inconsistency in this letter. Keith writes in here that they didn't know that she was convicted in a petty theft until after she testified. We know from the record that's not true. There was a discussion before she testified about her current case. The prosecutor who said he didn't know about it became aware of it then. So we already know that there's an inconsistency in here. We're not going to rely solely on the homicide captain's say-so that there was no deal. So there's no, I mean, there even, and that's putting aside what the prosecutor said. The whole point was Mr. Franklin's attorney wanted to ask her about a deal, and he was forbidden from doing it based on the prosecutor's representations. And now the attorney general expects us to say, well, he could have gone, despite what the prosecutor said, and despite the fact that you weren't allowed to ask your questions, well, you could have gone to the courthouse yourself and seen this little minute order, and everything would have been unveiled to you by then. That's just not reality. At the heart of this case is the possibility that Mr. Franklin is innocent, or that he was convicted on the basis of a witness whose appearance was as neutral, but in fact was not. And all he's asking for is a chance to have those issues heard by the federal court.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments today. And the case just heard will be submitted for decision. Your arguments are very helpful.